The idea was that if you have a circle that's 5 or 6 centimeters in diameter, if you put one lesion across that circuit anywhere, it will stop it. Well, if you put a lesion here and a lesion there and a lesion here and a lesion there, no, well, these things can't form. But what do you have afterwards? Well, you have an atrium that doesn't function because it's got incisions everywhere. So the trick was to figure out how can we put incisions in the heart that will absolutely preclude the development of atrial fibrillation. So the atrium can't fibrillate. But you leave an atrium that will still function in response to the sinus node. We knew that if we just bread loaf the atrium, that would cure atrial fibrillation 100% of the time, but you don't have anything left. So it occurred to me one day, like a lightning bolt, really, I know how to do this. If you put that pattern in the pattern of a maze, it'll still get rid of the atrial fib. But if you do it in the right way, then your sinus node beat will go around in the heart and you activate the whole heart. And so that's why I called it the maze procedure.
You're listening to Masterminds, where we sit down with experts in science and medicine to talk about everything from the research of today to the innovation of tomorrow. This is Mishka.
And this is Will. And today we're talking to the father of cardiac arrhythmia surgery, Dr. James Cox. The former division chief of cardiothoracic surgery here at WashU Med, Dr. Cox developed surgical procedures for multiple cardiac arrhythmias, including the Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, atrioventricular nodal reentry tachycardia, automatic atrial tachycardias, atrial flutter, atrial fibrillation, and ventricular tachycardia.
He is best known for developing the Cox-Maze procedure, the first cure for atrial fibrillation, which he performed for the first time at Barnes Jewish Hospital in 1987. Dr. Cox's contributions and developments forever changed the field of cardiac surgery and have saved countless lives. He currently conducts clinical research at Northwestern University.
Okay, Dr. Cox, thank you again for joining us. This is such a pleasure. So to start off, what in your childhood do you feel led you eventually to a career in medicine? And can you talk about how your education led you to where you are today?
Okay. The way I was, I guess, first interested in medicine, I thought I wanted to be a pharmacist. I grew up on a farm in Arkansas, and it was very difficult work. And the reason I wanted to be a pharmacist is that the drugstore was the only place that had air conditioning in the summertime. So I was interested in that, you know, maybe when I was 13 or 14. But once when I was 16 years old during the summer, I was sitting in the waiting room at a dental office. And I was looking through these magazines, and there was a magazine that had a full page spread of an open heart operation. And I looked at it, and I was just amazed, and I was aghast. And I thought, I remember exactly the thought was, what would a person have to do in life to be able to end up one day with that in his visual field? You know, I mean, that's, it was just like looking at a close-up of Mars or something. The operation was being done by Dr. Michael DeBakey, who was a very famous, probably the most famous ever heart surgeon down in Texas, in Houston. But I became interested in it then. And so I majored in pre-med like you have when I went off to college, and I played sports. And so I had a knee blown out. And while I was recuperating from that, I was taking a physiology course, and I got to the chapter on heart disease, and I was stuck after that. I mean, I thought it was, I was awake all night reading it. Normally lying in bed reading makes me go to sleep, but I stayed awake all night. So I knew that I wanted to study heart disease, and I liked the idea of doing cardiac surgery. It was very new at that time, and I liked using my hands and so on. So that's how I got started.
And something some people might not know, is this true that you were drafted by the Dodgers out of college? And obviously, instead of pursuing a professional baseball career, you chose to go into medicine. What was your love for baseball at all related to your desire to pursue medicine?
No, it was not related. It's a direct contrast to it, as a matter of fact. What you may not know is that the offer from the Dodgers, I received that on the same day that I received my acceptance to medical school. And I thought that it was far less likely that I would ever be a doctor. Just so nobody in my family had ever been a doctor or anything. So I thought that was a much bigger challenge. But the story is true. Yeah, but that was a long, long time ago.
So we want to go into talking about some of your early clinical work, but our podcast is sort of advertised to a broad range of audiences. We've got undergrads, but then we've also got people who are maybe not majoring in science. And so we kind of just wanted to start off with some basic questions. What is a cardiac arrhythmia? So how would you explain this to maybe a patient of yours that, has never heard of that before?
Well, you said this is going to be an audio thing, so I can't use my hands. I use my hands a lot in describing things. But I think that even lay people understand that the heartbeat occurs as a result of electrical stimulation. Just like the nerves stimulate our skeletal muscles, our biceps and triceps and so on. There's an automatic nervous system called the autonomic nervous system that stimulates the heart, whether you think of it or not. And it does it however often is needed to maintain a good status of the circulation of the body. So that electrical shock stimulates the muscle of the heart beats. And obviously it's done in a very regular manner. It's usually considered to be around 70 beats a minute. If you run or get excited, it may go up to 140, twice that. When you go to sleep at night, if you're in good physical shape, it may go down to well below 60. And all of that's normal, but it's always regular. An arrhythmia is a rhythm of the heart that is not regular. And as a result, it is detrimental to the pumping function of the heart. It's not only usually not regular, but it's usually fast. Now, you can have slow arrhythmias called bradycardias, or you can have fast arrhythmias called tachycardia. But the real problem with arrhythmias is that they're irregular. Most of them are. And if they are irregular, especially if they're irregular and fast, then it makes sense that the muscle contraction of the heart can't be as efficient as a pump as it can be when it's in a regular, nice rhythm of 70 beats per minute. So that's what an arrhythmia is, yes.
And in the spirit of defining terms, what's the difference between a cardiac arrhythmia versus, a cardiac arrest versus a heart attack? Because I know sometimes those terms get used interchangeably and sometimes wrongly.
Okay, let's go in reverse order. A heart attack, sure. Almost anything that happens to the heart, people say, well, he had a heart attack. And that is the most common thing that happens to people, but it's certainly not the only thing. So a heart attack occurs because the blood supply to the muscle of the heart is interrupted. There are three main arteries that sit on the surface of the heart, like the veins on the back of your hand, and they send branches down into the heart muscle, which is about as thick as your hand. And cross-section. If one of those arteries becomes blocked, then that portion of the heart muscle that's supplied by that artery no longer is receiving enough blood supply. So the muscle in that area that has lost its blood supply dies. That's what a heart attack is. Nothing more, nothing less. It's an area of the heart muscle that dies as a result of one of the feeding arteries becoming blocked. And that's where the arteriosclerosis and, coronary thrombosis and all those things come in. That's what a heart attack is. Now, heart attacks can result in arrhythmias. They're very dangerous arrhythmias. As a matter of fact, if somebody has a heart attack and the most dangerous of all arrhythmias occurs, which is called ventricular fibrillation, that equals death. So that's often called a cardiac arrest. And in a way, it is a cardiac arrest, but the heart completely loses all of its electrical synchronicity. And so it's just wiggling like a bag of worms, you know, it's just like this. It loses all pumping function. And that's what happens when somebody dies. That can happen after a heart attack. But in that case, you would not survive the heart attack. And when you hear somebody say, oh, he had a heart attack and died, or he died of a heart attack yesterday or whatever. So it's a sudden death due to a heart attack. That usually is due to a heart attack. And the rhythm, the arrhythmia, is called ventricular because that's the pumping chambers of the heart, it's the ventricle. And the rhythm is called fibrillation because it looks like a bag of worms to the naked eye. So it's just not contracting at all. So it's called ventricular fibrillation, or VFib. There are a lot of other arrhythmias that aren't that dangerous, some involving the lower pumping chambers of the heart and are called ventricular arrhythmias. And there are some that occur as a result of the upper two chambers of the heart, which is called atrial arrhythmias. Atria are the top two chambers, ventricles the lower two. So, for example, the most common arrhythmia in all of medicine is called atrial fibrillation. Well, whereas people die if the ventricles fibrillate, they don't die if the atria fibrillate. But they can have a lot of symptoms from it because they lose the pumping action of the upper two chambers of the heart. They're not the main chambers, but they provide about 20 to 30% of the overall function of the heart. So if you suddenly completely lose their contraction, then most people want to sit down, they get short of breath, may sweat a little bit, and can't do as much. Atrial fibrillation is by far the most common arrhythmia of the heart. So that's the difference in arrhythmias, heart attacks, and cardiac arrest.
And can you talk a little bit more about Wolff Parkinson-White syndrome? I was reading a little bit, and it sounds like a congenital heart defect that sort of happens at birth, you know, as opposed to some of these other atrial or cardiac arrhythmias that you might develop over the course of your life. Can you talk a little bit more about that syndrome specifically and some of the work that you've done to contribute to research about it?
Sure. And you're exactly right. It is a congenital abnormality. You're born with it. And normally, you know, to explain any arrhythmia, you have to understand something about the anatomy. So I'll try not to get too deep in that because of some non-scientists listening maybe. But the heart has four chambers, as I said, two upper chambers and two lower chambers. The two lower chambers are the main pumping chambers of the heart. Two upper chambers contribute maybe 20-30%. But this electrical spark that causes the heart to contract originates in the upper right chamber of the heart, and a tiny little area called the sinus node. And that's a place in the right atrium, the upper right chamber, where these specialized cells exist. And what's special about them? They're capable of generating an impulse like a battery. Okay, except you don't need to recharge them. So if you're exercising and the brain tells the heart, we need you to beat faster, then your heart rate will go up because the sinus node will start firing more often, okay? Normally, there's only one way, one tiny little way that the impulse that's generated in the upper chambers of the heart can get to the lower chambers of the heart, that are the pumping chambers. And that's through something called the AV node, which sits right in the center of the heart. So the impulse sparks in the right upper chamber, goes to the AV node, and then down to the ventricles, and the ventricles are, you know, contract and pump the blood. At no other position around, you know, the two upper chambers are obviously connected to the two lower chambers, right? Electrical activity from the upper chambers cannot get to the lower chambers without going through that AV node, okay? And that's because there's a pinching off process that occurs in utero before you're born, in which all connections between the upper two chambers and lower two chambers are severed, electrical connections, are blocked except for the AV node, okay? In patients with the Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, what we call it the WPW syndrome, that pinching off process fails in some spot. So you have a little tiny strand of muscle. It's atrial muscle from the upper chambers that connects to the ventricles directly. So now you have two connections from the upper chamber to the lower chamber, right? And the AV node, it will only conduct impulses at a certain rate because of the specialized cells. So your atrium can be going 300 a minute, but your ventricles would die if you went 300 a minute. So they are blocked by the AV node, let's say 2 to 1. So they'd be going 150 beats a minute, which is compatible with life. So the AV node serves as a filter for abnormal impulses in the atrium. I mentioned atrial fibrillation earlier, where the upper part of the atrium is going like this. Up to 600 impulses a minute can hit that AV node, but no more than 150 will get through. Okay. So now you've got this, what's called an accessory pathway between the atrium and the ventricle, and it doesn't have an AV node. So there is no protection against those impulses getting from the atrium to the ventricle. Now, usually that's not a problem, but you can understand if a patient who has the WPW syndrome and conducts from the atrium to the ventricle in two places, one unprotected, that if you develop atrial fibrillation with 600 beats a minute, it goes right down an accessory pathway and can fibrillate your ventricles and you die. Now, that's very rare, but in our experience at WashU over the years, we found that we had about, I think, 20 or 22 patients who had had a cardiac arrest because they had the WPW syndrome and developed a run of atrial fib. The average age of those people was 14 years. So they were all young people. Some of them had been, one I remember, had been resuscitated standing in line at a McDonald's because there was an EMT standing behind him. So I had another one who was the national AAU champion indoor cyclist. And he was leading in the national championship. And when he got to the last lap, you know how they fire a gun when you start the last lap? It startled him because it went off right next to him. And he immediately went into atrial fib, keeled over, and basically died on the track. Somebody came and resuscitated. So that's what the WPW syndrome is. The most common problem of the WPW syndrome is the impulse comes down the AV node to the ventricles, back up retrograde across the accessory connection to the atria, and it goes around and around, and that will go about 240 times a minute. So it doesn't kill you, but it makes you feel really bad. So the operation that was developed to cure that depends on having an electronic system in the operating room that allows you to actually map the electrical impulses on the surface of the heart. And you can identify precisely where that little hairline fiber is. You never see it, it's too small. But you can then do a dissection, a surgical dissection in that area, block that, and the patient's cured. I've often said that the WPW patients are the only patients that cardiac surgeons ever operate on and actually cure them. You know, we don't cure coronary disease, we don't cure valve disease, we don't cure congenital heart disease, we just make it better. But in this specific case, you really do cure the patient with the WPW syndrome because the rest of their heart is perfectly normal.
And Dr. Cox, I think you're being a little too modest here because you developed the Cox-Mays procedure to surgically treat AFib. And if my research is correct, it was a patient, George Deere, who might have inspired it.
On your homework.
Can you tell us the story of how that happened?
Yeah, I mentioned that there are a lot of different arrhythmias. WPW, I always say it is God's gift to arrhythmia surgeons because it involves what we call a reentry, the reentry of electrical activity around a big area. And you know exactly where it's going once you map it. It's going through the AV node and the accessory pathway. That was the basis for the development of everything that happened after that in terms of developing surgical procedures for the treatment of arrhythmias. And so I was at Duke for about 15 years before I came to Boy, she was the chief back years ago. And while we were still at Duke, we developed about five different operations to cure five different kinds of arrhythmias, okay? One of which was the WPW syndrome, which I didn't develop that one. Anyhow, the only thing that we had not developed an operation to fix because it was so complex was atrial fibrillation. And we didn't have any way to map it. So we didn't know exactly what was going on like we did with things like the WPW syndrome. So at Wash U, one of the first things we did in the first couple of 3 years is we developed this mapping system. It was actually a three-dimensional mapping system. After the three-dimensional mapping became available, and that was all developed at Wash U over in laboratory areas, then we were able to understand atrial fib and then start working on an operation to stop it. And that's what led to the first one of those operations. Now, we had developed some other operations in the lab at Wash U that didn't work. And that's the time that I got a call from an airline pilot in Cyprus named George Deere. And so George called and said, I'm up to become the chief pilot at Cyprus Airways, except I have this problem called atrial fibrillation and they've grounded me. And for those who don't know, which is probably most people, Cyprus Airways is a very elite airline. It's like Singapore. People think about Singapore Airways being there. Cyprus Airways is really one of the boutique airlines in the world. That's fantastic airlines. So their pilots were the absolute best in the world. They could get anybody they wanted. And George was up to be the main pilot, and he was 37 years old. Pretty good. And needless to say, George was not somebody who either doubted himself or his judgment or lacked any courage whatsoever. So I received a call from him, and we were this was before the maze. And he said he wanted to come to St. Louis. He could fly anywhere he wanted to in the world free, of course. He said, I want to come to St. Louis and see what you're doing. And the reason he knew to call me was a few years before I'd written an article entitled The Surgical Treatment of Atrial Fibrillation. However, I wasn't really treating atrial fib. I was treating WPW patients who had atrial fib. And so I'd get rid of their WPW and then their atrial fib would go away. He misunderstood that part. But nevertheless, that's where he got my name, I guess. And he said, I want to see I need an operation. And I said, well, we don't have one for atrial fib. He said, well, I'm going to come over and see what you do have. And so he flew over and he spent about a week at Barnes. And we took him over to the research facilities and showed him all the stuff we were doing. And we had an operation then that we were calling the atrial transection procedure. And it was working in animals, but we'd never tried it in human beings. And we didn't think we were ready to try it yet. Well, he put enormous pressure on us to operate on it. And we argued for a week or 10 days. I had, electrophysiologists and ethics people and everybody else. And we said, no, we're not going to do it. I told him, I said, I just don't feel like it's ready to go. So he went back to Cyprus, very disgruntled, but he called our laboratory people once a week. Where are you now? Where are you now? Well, in the ensuing year, more or less, we got the three-dimensional mapping system going. We said, aha, this is what's going on. And so we developed the maze procedure and started testing it in the lab. It worked every time. And so I went through the investigational review board, which you'll learn about later, and got approval to do one case based on all the stuff we'd done. And George was aware of all of it. And I should mention, George came back after 6 months and said, I'm not leaving until you do this on me. And we did an atrial transection procedure on him, okay, before the maze procedure. And it worked for about 5 months. And then he went back into atrial fib. So we, in the meantime, have been developing everything else. Finally, was comfortable in doing the first maze procedure on a patient. And we did that operation, and it worked. It worked well. But George knew about that. So he started calling that patient. He called him every month. I said, we're not doing another one for 6 months until we make sure this one did okay, you know, past 5 months. And so at the exact end of that 6 months, George was in Barnes Hospital, insisting that we do a maze procedure. Well, that involved converting him from the incisions we had used on his atrium for the atrial transection to what would was equivalent to a maze procedure. And it worked fine. And then he developed a problem a little later called, George did. The first patient did fine. And actually, the person I thought knew more about atrial fibrillation than anybody in the world is a professor named Mart Selesi from the University of Limburg in Maastricht in the Netherlands. And it was at a conference with him and a few others where we had published the book that had my chapter in it about the surgical treatment of atrial fibrillation, which George had read. Anyhow, the first patient did well. And Dr. Alessi happened to be visiting WashU on the day that we saw him back in the clinic for the first day. It was a month after his surgery. And so I said, well, Morris has got to come up to the clinic. I want you to see a patient with me here. That was third floor Barnes Hospital. And the fourth floor. And I said, I want you to feel this guy's pulse. And so he felt his pulse. And he said, yeah, it's normal rhythm. And I said, this guy's had an operation for atrial fibrillation. He couldn't believe it, you know. But I always remembered that the one person in the world that I had to convince this operation worked was happened to be there a month after we had done one. So that was an interesting story. George was the second person we did. George did fine. He had some problems with atrial flutter, which is another arrhythmia, which we eventually got rid of. And he never had another arrhythmia. He sent airline tickets to me and my wife to come to Cyprus about almost 2 years after his operation. And we did. And it was a fabulous trip. We sat in the cockpit of the airplane, you know, because all the pilots knew him. And so it was really a fantastic experience. George, to finish the story, George was 37, 38, I guess, when I operated on him. When he was about 55 or so, he was vacuuming the floor for his wife and dropped dead of a heart attack, which you asked about earlier. And his daughter, I got to know his family very well, and his daughter called me crying on the telephone. I still say that's one of the saddest days of my life, because he was, if it hadn't been for George Deere, I don't think we would ever, at least the MACE procedure would have been delayed several years, I'm sure.
Wow, that's a great story. Can you describe some of the specifics of the procedure?
Sure. Again, in order to know the operation, you have to know what the problem is. So in atrial fibrillation, what happens is it just degenerates into what we thought was a chaotic arrhythmia. And I'll throw another little story in here. Because I was at a conference with Mart Selesi in Maastricht 1 year, and I was standing in line, and this little guy with wiry hair came up and said, could I see your book? Because we had put it in a book, and I had it under my arm standing in line. And I said, sure. So I gave it to him, and he started slowly going through. I said, well, why don't you tell me what you're looking for? Maybe I could save you some time. He said, well, my wife has mitral valve disease and atrial fibrillation, and I'm trying to see if there's anything in here about it. I said, well, let's sit down and talk. And so we started talking, and it turns out he was the recently retired professor and chairman of the Department of Theoretical and Pure Mathematics at Cambridge. So we didn't have much in common. And he was in his 70s or maybe even 80s, I don't know. And so we started talking, and during the course of it, he said, you know, as a professor, he said, are you doing any research? And I said, yes, I'm doing research on an arrhythmia that's basically a chaotic arrhythmia. But when I said chaotic, you could almost see his ears point up, because he said, well, you know, my people in Cambridge are the world's experts on the chaos theory. That's where it was generated and so on. I said, well, I didn't know that, but I'm impressed. he said, would you come over and give us some of your raw data and let our guys look at it and see, prove to you that it's not chaotic? I said, you want me to give a lecture to the Department of Pure Mathematics at Cambridge? And he said, absolutely. I said, well, I'll give a lecture on atrial fib, but it's not going to have much math in it. So anyhow, I took a whole bunch, and we still were doing analog recordings then. We didn't have digital computer recording at the time, because this is the, the mid-80s, I guess. And so I went over there, took a couple of suitcases full of raw data, and had a very nice time. What we learned, not just from there, but we'd learned with our three-dimensional mapping, is that atrial fibrillation is in fact not a chaotic arrhythmia. It looks chaotic if you just, you know, if you don't know what you're looking at, but it is a series of large areas of electrical activity that circles back on itself. So if you envision atrial fibrillation, you can think of it as being a lot of circles on the atrium, okay, from 2 to 6. And so the idea was that if you have a circle that's 5 or 6 centimeters in diameter, if you put one lesion across that circuit anywhere, it will stop it. Well, if you put a lesion here and a lesion there and a lesion here and a lesion there, no, well, these things can't form. But what do you have afterwards? Well, you have an atrium that doesn't function because it's got incisions everywhere. So the trick was to figure out, how can we put incisions in the heart that will absolutely preclude the development of atrial fibrillation? So the atrium can't fibrillate. But you leave an atrium that will still function in response to the sinus node. We knew that if we just bread loaf the atrium, that will cure atrial fibrillation 100% of the time, but you don't have anything left. So it occurred to me one day, like a lightning bolt, really, I know how to do this. If you put that pattern in the pattern of a maze, it'll still get rid of the atrial fib. But if you do it in the right way, then your sinus node beat will go around in the heart and you activate the whole heart. And so that's why I called it the maze procedure.
So since you performed the first maze procedure in 1987, there have been significant developments over time where I think now we're on the maze 4 procedure. Can you talk about some of the changes that have been made to your original procedure since and how they have benefited patients and maybe some drawbacks?
Yeah, if you consider the very first maze procedure, the maze 1, which is how we now refer to it, we had some problems with it. So we altered it into the maze 2. Had some problems with that. We altered it into the maze 3. And that was just a matter of slightly changing exactly where we put the lesions in the atrium. Once we developed maze 3, worked every time, it's great, exactly what we wanted. We did lots and lots of patients that way, but we were at the time doing it with a knife and scissors through a big incision in the middle of the chest, open heart surgery of the first order. In 96 or 97, so more or less 10 years after we developed after we did the first one, we figured out a way of doing it through a very tiny incision in the right chest without opening a patient's chest like we'd done before. But in order to do that, we had to stop making the lesions with the knife and scissors. We started making them with linear cryoprobes that had become available. And so we changed it to a minimally invasive cryomaze 3 procedure, is what we call it. That was in 96 or 97. And so all of those variations were made. The only difference the cryomaze 3 is that it was made with smaller chest incision, and all of the lesions were created with a cryoprobe, not with a knife and scissors. We didn't make surgical incisions anymore. And then in 2002, I guess, Ralph Damiano, who had worked in my research lab when I was at Duke, and we'd been long-time friends and so on, some new instruments have come out, namely bipolar radiofrequency surgical clamps. And another version of the cryoprobe system, and he used those to create essentially the lesions of the Mays 3 procedure and named it the Mays 4 procedure. And so since that time, depending on exactly what the approach is and who the surgeon is, some surgeons do a Mays 3, some do a Mays 4. It doesn't make any difference, same operation. And so we actually refer to it typically as the Mays 3/4 procedure. The person I work with here at Northwestern now, Pat McCarthy, who was the second person to do Mays procedures, he used to come down to St. Louis from the Cleveland Clinic. Every time I did a Mays, he'd be standing over my shoulder and start dictating and so on and so forth. And he really learned it and did it well. He has just developed a way using cryoprobes that are very cold cryoprobes. By shaping them, he can do the operation even faster than the Mays 4. So he does the Mays 3, cryo-Mays 3, faster than the Mays 4. Those are really the only modifications in the Mays procedure that have been made, and they've all been made, you know, basically in a stepwise fashion. Now, problem comes when all these other operations are called a Mays procedure. Anytime somebody does anything to the atrium to treat atrial fibrillation, regardless of what it is, it's called a Mays procedure. And I've equated that to going up to a kiosk sometime and saying, I'd like a Coke. And they hand you a Pepsi Light. And you say, yeah, that's fine. You know, and you do, I mean, all brown, sweet, fuzzy colas are Cokes. You know, so it's a generic term for brown, sweet, fuzzy, fizzy colas. And the Mays procedure has become a generic term for anything done to the atrium. That's where all the confusion is, because the surgeons around the world who do either a Mays 3 or a Mays 4 get exactly the same results that I get. The guy here gets, Ralph Damiano gets it, Washi, same results. So it's not surgeon specific, it's procedure specific. But there's just an enormous amount of confusion that's been put into the literature, dumped into the literature with these operations, the mini Mays procedure and the five box Mays procedure and the Dallas Mays procedure. And the, you know, there are 50 of them and they all get lousy results, all of them. And so, they're usually done because the Mays 3 and Mays 4 is a bit more difficult to do. It's more difficult to understand, and it requires top flight surgeons to do it. So that's the only thing that's downside of it. I think probably the most valuable thing that has come from it is the fact that for the first time ever, we actually understood atrial fib. And the cardiologists started trying to do it. A Mays procedure with a catheter in the early 90s, and it was an unmitigated disaster. It's too complex to do with a catheter. But then Michel Hassegger from Bordeaux in France developed, remember I said we never did detect where it was being generated, where atrial fib was being started or induced? Hassegger found that. It's all mostly around the pulmonary veins. So he, with a catheter, you can isolate the pulmonary veins. So all of a sudden, all the cardiologists, electrophysiologists in the world started doing catheter ablation. Now, they still can't come close to the surgical results, but we're doing an open chest operation and they're doing a blood vessel puncture in the groin. It's a lot of difference. They can fail to, I mean, they can afford to fail when you're not being any more invasive than that. And if you fail, you can bring the patient back and do it again. You can't bring them back over and over and over for open heart surgery. And in the most recent years, what's happened since about 10 years ago, maybe 12, is that surgeons and cardiologists have gotten together and do part of the operation through a thoracoscope in one of the chest walls, and then follow that up either immediately or a few weeks later with an endocardial catheter ablation. They're called hybrid procedures. And the hybrid procedures, the results of the hybrid procedures are just about equal halfway between the excellent results of surgery and the less excellent results of catheter ablation. And so hybrid procedures have been pretty hot now, especially for the last decade.
So your career has been extremely productive even after you've left WashU, and currently you're at Northwestern Medicine doing a lot of clinical studies in the field of cardiac surgery. Could you talk about some of what you see as challenges in the current state of treatment for cardiac arrhythmias and how you hope to improve them?
Sure. Just to clarify, I left WashU several years ago and went actually to Georgetown as chairman of the department there. And I had to have both my knees replaced at the same time. And I had deep vein thrombophlebitis and pulmonary emboli and everything else. So I stopped operating several years ago. So I had basically retired from clinical practice several years ago. And because I just couldn't do it. So what I did is I started consulting with a lot of different companies who had facilities to do research. So we were able to continue to do it. That's worked out very well. But I basically retired for 10 years or more. And Pat McCarthy, chief of cardiac surgery here, I told you was the one who used to stand and look over my shoulder and dictate when I was doing it down in St. Louis. He was at the Cleveland Clinic. He was a younger guy. He invited me to come up to be a visiting professor here for 2 or 3 days. And while I was here, I was actually living in Denver at the time. And while I was here, we started talking about, he said, would you have any interest in coming back into academics and out of retirement? I said, well, I don't operate anymore and so forth. So that's how I ended up in Northwestern. That was 7 years ago. That was almost 8 years ago. And one of the things that intrigued me was that Patrick, at one time in the 30 years ago, he and I were the only two surgeons in the world doing this operation. Ralph Damiano was still in his residency at Duke. Neve Ad was still a teenager in Israel. Those are the guys that do most now. And so on. So Pat and I were the only ones doing it. And he was at the Cleveland Clinic. So I used to go to the Cleveland Clinic and, you know, we'd do some up there and then he'd come down to WashU and we'd do some down there. But when I'd done about, I don't know, 80 or 90 of them, Patrick had done probably 20 or 30 of them. And so we were the only two people in the world who had a series of MACE patients. So we went way back. And so he, after several years at the Cleveland Clinic, came to Northwestern as the chairman in 2004 and has built an absolutely magnificent program here. And then I came up to go to be a visiting professor for a few days and he started talking and I said, well, yeah, that might be fun. So I moved from Denver to Chicago. and so I've been here for 7 or 8 years now. Now, in terms of what we do here, I have been most heavily involved in research, I guess, is the best way to put it. Some resident teaching, not as much as I'd like, but, you know, the resident's always in the operating room and I don't go to the operating room anymore, except on special occasions. But so I spend most of my time in research and that's worked out very well. We've published a lot of work on atrial fib. In 2010, I think Isaac asked me about what we're doing now. In 2010, a new energy source came along, which was called ultra low near critical nitrogen. And I won't go into all the details, but suffice to say that the coldest thing in the universe is liquid nitrogen. And while I was still at Duke years ago, we tried to use liquid nitrogen as a cryogen to treat arrhythmias. But it takes something the size of a garden hose to deliver it. So around the late aughts, around 2010, some very brilliant people figured out how to suspend liquid nitrogen in a gaseous form so that it maintains its same ability to extract heat that liquid nitrogen does, but its viscosity is such that you can pass it through a pencil lid. Well, that's what I've been waiting on for years. And I learned about this actually in 2005, but to start, in 2009 or 10, we founded a company out in Laguna Hills and started raising money for it so we could do the research that we needed to do. And the idea was that if I could give this catheter to the electrophysiologist, they should be able to do exactly the same thing to the heart that I can do with a knife or a surgical cryoprobe. And if they can, they'll get the same results. They won't be getting these lousy results. We know what you have to do to the heart to cure the problem. How are you going to do it? Are you going to do it with a big operation and get good results, or with a small catheter ablation and get lousy results, or a hybrid procedure and get intermediate results? So that's it's just a matter of choice. So the objective was to develop a catheter that would allow them to get the same results. And so I spent a lot of time in the last 10 or 12 years on that. And we've used it in Europe several times. Several times. We had several clinical trials with it and so on. And it works extremely well. So we'll probably, hopefully, be selling a company one of these days. But I've worked on that and the research we do here at Northwestern. So it's been a very nice way to finish one's career and a bit just to be allowed to do anything.
Yes, you've had such an impressive and inspiring career. And I think our audience, since it's mostly college students, would like to know if you have any advice for future doctors and college students going forward in their careers.
Well, college students, I would probably be better for medical students, but I think, you know, I know how hard it is to get into medical school now. It's always been that way. The 2,000 people applying for one position and all that stuff, believe me, it's always been that way. But the students that we're getting now are really quite remarkable. And, you know, you will learn things in medical school that I still don't know anything about. And certainly I don't know what's being taught in medical school anymore. But you do learn the basics there that will allow you to branch out and do whatever you're going to do in the future to make a difference. I think that for the college students, I would say don't be discouraged. If you really want to do this, you can figure out a way to do it in most cases. Now, you have to have certain qualifications and so on and so forth. But if you really want it badly enough, you can still do it. I think it maybe was a little bit, I don't know. I don't know if it's any different now than it was years ago, but probably is more difficult now. I just don't know. Once you get into medical school, it's great because you can drop all that other zoology and biochemistry and everything and focus on what you want to do. And I mean, the time in my life I think I enjoyed the most was probably medical school. Once you are applying to medical school or you're in medical school and you're applying for a residency program, I think the objective should be simple in terms of where you decide to go. And, you know, should I interview at six places and try to match with one of them, you know, whatever. One, never underestimate yourself. That's a very common, I can't go there, so I don't even know why. That's a bad thing to do. But the other is, once you get into a program, whether it's in the medical school, it's more appropriate for the residency program. So you've got 10 years to train to be a cardiac surgeon after you get out of medical school. I can remember very well rounding my first day as an intern at Duke. And I was rounding with the chief resident who had been there 10 years. And I was absolutely blown away by how much this guy knew. I thought, I will never be able to learn all the stuff that guy knows. Well, you see, that's a bad observation, because you don't want to, you don't know one-tenth of what he knows. But the person you want to train yourself to be is the second-year resident. You do whatever, when you're a first-year resident, whatever it takes to be the very best second-year resident you can be. You're going to learn a lot that year, too. Second-year resident, you learn what you want to be the best third-year resident you can be, and so on. And by the time you get to the 10th year, you wake up and say, I know just as much as that guy did, you know. I mean, it's just the way it works. And so don't be discouraged by how stupid you feel when you first start seeing patients. And I think focus and so on is extremely important. Above all else is hard work. And, you know, Sir William Osler said that hard work makes a a mediocre doctor, excellent doctor, makes an excellent doctor, super, whatever he said. You know, the point is that the thing that separates people is heart, is the willingness to work hard. And medicine, you've picked a very difficult profession, and it's difficult all the way through. But you've also picked the most wonderful one you can imagine. And I don't think there could be anything possibly as rewarding as being a doctor. And I'm really glad that there are two groups of people who are glad that I did not choose baseball. One was me, and the other was the Dodgers. I don't think I would have helped them much. But anyhow, that's it.
Thank you, Dr. Cox. That's very inspiring words and a perfect close to this interview. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you again. I'm very honored and flattered that you'd asked me to do this, and I've enjoyed talking with you.
We hope you enjoyed our fascinating discussion with Dr. Cox as much as we did. It's one thing to learn standard of practice from a textbook in medical school, but not just anyone can pioneer new standards of practice.
But above it all, Dr. Cox's story is one of a physician who cared deeply about his patients and did not stop until he found a solution to their problem. If you like the Masterminds podcast, you can support us by following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Masterminds Pod. Please leave comments on any of our latest posts if there are any topics or guests you would like to include on future episodes. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Masterminds.